The 100 Years War, the Duguesclin Period, the Portugal Expedition, Part 3. Well, the Portuguese Cortes met probably early in September to authorize a mass requisition of horses and mules. Finding at least 3,000 animals in a country as small as Portugal without dismounting Don Fernando's own troops was a major undertaking which took some time. Many of them proved to be of low quality or unbroken. The English won many admirers among the Portuguese for the skill with which they managed these wild and unsuitable beasts, but the whole process cost them 2 months of campaign timing. The leaders of the army passed most of the time comfortably installed in the suburban monasteries of Lisbon while their men camped in the fields by the Tagus River, north of the city. But as autumn wore on, they grew bored and ran out of money. Discipline broke down. The English and their Gascon and Hainault auxiliaries began to break in the suburban houses and rural farms, to sack the outlying villages and pillage along the roads around the capital. The Earl of Cambridge proved quite incapable of restoring order. Stories of appalling atrocities began to circulate, which no doubt grew in the telling. Within a few weeks, the English were profoundly hated, or at least around the area of Lisbon. Meanwhile, the Castilian offensive had made a halting start. John of Trastamara entered Portugal with the main body of his army towards the end of July 1381, attacking west of the Castilian city of Ciudad Rodrigo, laying siege to Almeida. In the southern sector, the master of the Sicilian Order of Santiago launched a simultaneous offensive from Vazoy and besieged Elvas. These two border fortresses, repeatedly expanded and rebuilt, had been the principal eastern defenses of Portugal since the 12th century, and would remain so until the 19th century. Almeida was poorly defended. The town surrendered the Castilians on August the 9th, and the castle some 3 weeks later. But further progress then came to a halt. King John, whose constitution was never up to the rigors of campaigning, fell ill. Then, when the news of the English landings reached him, he lost his nerve. The southern arm of the Castilian pincer movement was abandoned, and the troops around Elvas brought north to reinforce the army at Almeida. A messenger was sent to the Earl of Cambridge at Lisbon with a challenge to fight an arranged battle somewhere between Lisbon and the frontier. But it was an empty gesture. The Earl ignored the challenge, and Fernando had the unfortunate Castilian messenger who delivered it in the prison. Towards the end of September of 1381, the Castilian king withdrew to the castle of Coca near Segovia. The financial strain was more than the Castilian treasury could bear. The troops at Almeida, the seamen and the shipwrights at Seville, and the Basque ports, and the permanent garrisons on the frontiers of Navarre and Granada were all clamoring for their pay. The Castilian Cortes set intermittently for some 2 months in Avila between October and December before authorizing another large increase in taxation. John of Trastamara could not believe that his enemies would remain immobile throughout the winter. He made plans to deploy a great army, 5,000 strong, along the border to contain them. In fact, a winter campaign never seems to have been contemplated. Since the English armies were famous for their indifference to the seasons, this was presumably Fernando's decision. A more vigorous proconsul might have shifted the Portuguese king from this position, but the Earl of Cambridge simply accepted the situation as he found it. His army remained in his encampments around Lisbon until the end of the year. They were needed to defend the capital and the English fleet against Sanchez de Tovar's Castilian galleys cruising offshore. In December of 1381, the galleys finally returned to Seville to be laid up for the winter, and the English ships were able to leave for home. As soon as they had gone, Fernando left to celebrate Christmas, while the Earl of Cambridge departed with his unruly troops for winter quarters in the valley of the Guadiana, closer to Portugal's eastern frontier. The Earl established his headquarters in an Augustinian monastery outside the walls of Villa Visco, about 10 miles behind the frontier, and waited for spring. Early in December 1381, a squire arrived in England from Lisbon with a report to the council and the Duke of Lancaster. It must have been a somber reading. The Earl of Cambridge took the blackest possible view of his situation. He seems to have concluded that nothing could be expected from the Portuguese army, and his own force was at risk of destruction. destruction unless it received rapid and powerful reinforcements from England. For an army which had not even taken the field, this was an extraordinary statement. John of Gaunt felt that his great adventure ought to be on the verge of triumph. He was determined that the chance not escape him now, so he resolved to take command in Portugal himself. He would bring another 4,000 men with him. These plans were completely unrealistic. The main problem, as always, was finance. The Earl of Cambridge's army had been paid a quarter's wages in advance before leaving England. The next quarter's wages were supposed to come from the Portuguese king's treasury. Thereafter, the position was somewhat uncertain, no one having anticipated that the army would spend such a long time in Portugal. The men were now pressing for their third quarter pay. The cost of meeting their arrears and sending a second army out under Gaunt himself was reckoned at another £60,000 for 6 months. Parliament returned from its Christmas adjournment on January the 24th, 1382. The business of the new session was dominated by John of Gaunt's great project. The Duke's unpopularity was always its strongest when he seemed to be controlling the business of government. The mood in London was highly charged. The message was too obvious to be missed. In the Palace of Westminster, John of Gaunt gave the peers the substance of the Earl of Cambridge's bleak message. He told them that it was essential to rescue the army in Portugal. He argued that this was in England's interest, not just his own. Successful war against the Testamoran dynasty in Castile was the best way of assuring the defense of the seas and the coast around England, and Gaunt was realistic enough not to suggest that the commons should finance his Portuguese venture, not at least not outright. What he proposed was that the money should be lent to him by the crown for 3 years, with repayment secured on the income of his English estates. The details of the scheme have not survived, but Gaunt appears to have envisaged that the crown would raise £60,000 from taxation, and that his repayments would then be used to reduce the need for further parliamentary taxes in the future. But however ingenuously wrapped, what John Gaunt was really asking for was a new parliamentary subsidy following hard on the disastrous poll tax of the previous year. His demands generated acrimonious discussion at Westminster, which continued for more than a fortnight, 14 days. It divided the Lords where Gaunt's natural supporters were to be found. Most of them accepted his arguments, but the important minority was afraid of another popular uprising and unwilling to denude the country of troops. The Commons rejected the proposal on more fundamental grounds. War taxation had continued year on year for too long, they said. They would not authorize a new subsidy, whether by way of loan or grant. All that they would do was extend the modest supplementary export duties originally granted at Gloucester in 1377 for another 4.5 years in order to finance the defense of England. The government wanted to mount an offensive operation. It would have to find some other way of paying for it. As for Gaunt's pursuit of the Castilian throne, that they declared to be his own affair and nothing to do with them. On this note, the proceedings were brought to a close. So next time we'll be looking a little bit at how the French are dealing with what's going on in Portugal. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.